I don't know whether I made the assignment for today altogether clear at the end of the hour, but I posted it the next day on the bulletin board, so I trust most of you saw it there. The assignment had two parts. It was to look through Daniel 7 and see which verses are part of the vision and which are part of the interpretation, and also to see which are figurative or symbolic and which are literal. Now, most of you did very well on it. There were two or three from whom I expected good papers who I was afraid, I came to the conclusion that they either weren't listening at the end of the hour and didn't see it on the board, or that they're much poorer in exegesis than I thought they were, because they simply gave me a general comparison of chapter 7 and chapter 2 as to the general course of events. And that, of course, was not included in the assignment at all. And that would not detract from the mark, but it couldn't add anything to it, because they didn't deal with the two things I asked for at all, which were which parts are part of the vision and which are literal, as which are parts of the vision of the interpretation and which are figurative and which are literal. Now, one or two, I got the impression, didn't really understand what we mean by figurative and or symbolic. And I think it's worth taking a minute or two on that right now. In Daniel 2, we had a vision given, a vision or a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And Daniel described the vision to Nebuchadnezzar in verses 31 to 35. And every single thing in that vision was figurative. It was a symbol. And as we have noticed, if you simply heard that vision, you couldn't have any idea what much of it meant. They are symbols, they are figures. And unless you've seen the same figures used in some other time, you have no way to approach it. Or unless you have an idea what it's supposed to describe and you can make a comparison, you have no way to approach it. It is strictly figurative. Now, perhaps strictly is just a little bit too strong, but mighty little, because the only thing I notice in it that is at all literal is the statement at the end, it filled the whole earth. Whatever it was, filled the whole earth. Now that, of course, is a rather literal statement, but it could be part of a dream which he had. But up to that, there's a statue there. And as we've noticed, there are many things in the statue. We don't know just how many there were. We don't know how many fingers were visible. We don't have any reason to think the two arms and the chest had a specific reference as to parts of the second kingdom or anything of the kind. We don't have any definite evidence as to specific meanings of the first three medals. We are told that the fourth one indicates strength. But there are many things in it that are figures and maybe just part of the general picture. As to what parts of it do have a meaning and what they mean, we would have no basis whatever to go on if we didn't have the interpretation. Of course, this was just a dream. And in the dream, did he see a globe and see the stone just flowing around and covering the whole globe? Or did he simply see the stone enlarging so that it covered everything he could see? We just don't know. Now, when we get to the interpretation, there we have a literal interpretation, and there we have to ask the question that you just raised. What does the interpretation mean in that regard? But that is a question which I don't think I want to take time going into here right now. It's the sort of question I'd rather you give me in writing, and then I'll see whether it fits in somewhere in the course of our discussion or whether I should discuss it with you personally. I think that would fit in somewhere, and I wish you would give it to me in writing. But that is all figure. That is all symbol. And then we have the interpretation, which is separated by a verse from the vision. The two are completely separate and distinct in Daniel 2. And then when you come to the interpretation in Daniel 2, the interpretation is all, I believe, literal. That is to say, it contains an occasional repetition of a phrase. Whereas you saw this, that means this. Whereas you saw that, it means this. And the full meaning may not be explained. You can infer sometimes, but except for repetitions, it is entirely literal. Now, when you come to chapter 7, the situation is very different. So different that I have made a statement, a list of it that I think would be interesting for you to look at. Would you pass these out, please? Now, this statement is on the lower part of the page. So don't look at the upper page for the present moment. We've come to that a little later. But in the lower part of the page, I've mentioned that in chapter 7, the vision runs from verse 2 to verse 14. And that vision is figurative, except for the last verse of it. The last verse of it would seem to be quite definitely literal. But the rest of it is clearly figurative. Now, I said with the possible exception of much of 9, 10, and 13. There are certain questions in those three verses as to just what is literal and what is figurative. Has everyone a copy now? As I stayed down there, the vision in chapter 7 runs from 2 to 14. I think that is quite obvious. And it is all figurative except the last verse, except verse 14. When it says in verse 14, there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. That is a pretty literal statement. Now, how would you see that in a vision? It's still part of the vision. Perhaps a voice said it, and he heard it. But we don't know. At any rate, it is quite a literal statement. But the rest of the vision is figurative, except that in verses 9, 10, and 13, there are certain statements on which we might have a question. And we will look at them later when we look at it in detail. But then a very interesting thing in chapter 7 is that the interpretation which is given is part of the vision. You notice I've said here, interpretation still in vision. The whole thing was a vision that Daniel had. But in the vision, we read that Daniel, verse 10, 16 says, came near to one of those that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. And he told me and made me know the interpretation of it. So then we have an interpretation given, which is only three verses. And these three verses are literal, with the possible exception, I don't think it's really one, but with the possible exception of the phrase at the end of verse 17. And then the strange thing here is that after he's been given this very brief interpretation, which quickly summarizes the whole thing, then in verse 19, we find that Daniel expresses a desire for more information, and he repeats a part of the vision. And as he repeats a part of the vision, he gives a little more detail than he'd given before. So we have a further description of part of the vision in verses 19 to 22. And verses 19 to 20 are figurative, clearly figurative, and verses 21 to 22 are mostly literal. And then in answer to this further question, which gave us further repetition in part and addition in part of what he'd seen already in the vision, then we have an interpretation from 23 to 28a, which is strictly literal. It's interesting to see how different it is from the very simple arrangement that we have in chapter 2. Now, that was the assignment for today. And we go back now to chapter 2. And in chapter 2, we were looking at E. We were looking at E, the fifth part of the statute. I had just a couple of lines here that were on the last sheet that I didn't bring with me. Starting with F, I'll have it for you on the board again. I think I gave you number 2, didn't I, under E? Note the symbolic meaning of potter's clay, weak or brittle. I gave you 3, did I? Yes, that is three under E, under capital E. Capital E was, does the statement in verse 43 simply mean an unintegrated mixture of peoples? And under that, it mentioned small a, if so, it will fit the whole history of each of these empires. The Babylonians not only conquered many nations, but they mixed them together. They carried people off from one section to another and from that to a third and so on. And so they were all mixed. So the statement in verse 43 about the feet being mixed with iron and clay, and it says specifically in verse 43, that whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Well, the mixture of iron and clay is clearly a statement, this is to be weak or brittle. But this verse seems to go beyond that. It's the most simple suggestion of it is that it is an unintegrated mixture of peoples. But if so, it would fit the Babylonian Empire. It would fit the Persian Empire, which conquered many kingdoms and which mixed them together to some extent. It would fit the Hellenistic Empire, which conquered the whole Persian Empire and made a great conglomeration of peoples with a small group of Greeks or Macedonians controlling the whole. It would certainly fit the Roman Empire. And so it doesn't seem to be anything distinctive if all it means is an unintegrated mixture of peoples, except that perhaps the mixture became greater between 400 and 600 A.D. than before, because at that time Germanic tribes were marching back and forth across the Roman Empire, pillaging and destroying and settling down here and there. But there had been Germanic peoples entering the Roman Empire for the previous six centuries, but entering in small groups and being assimilated. So it might fit that period a little better, but it could fit any period. But I have here number B, the possibility remains that it points to some factor that is not obvious. Yes. The possibility remains it points to some factor that is not obvious. Let me read verse 43 again to you as it stands in the King James Version. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Some have tried to make out that it shows intermarriage of ruling families. Well, there was that in all the kingdoms, every one of them. So that certainly wouldn't be a distinctive feature. There was that at just about every period. And so that wouldn't be distinctive of the last part. It's a peculiar statement. And it may simply mean an unintegrated mixture of peoples which became more pronounced from 400 to 600 than ever before. Or it may include some element that is not clear to us. And if any of you have any good suggestions as to what it might be, I wish you'd write them out and give them to me. I confess that as of the present, I'm not sure it does represent something more than that, but the peculiar language suggests it to me very strong. But what it is, I do not know. Now we go on to number four. Number four, the marked similarity of this part, that is the fifth part of the image, the feet and toes, the marked similarity of this part to the condition of the Roman Empire between A.D. 400 and 600 should be noted. I just mentioned that fact. The marked similarity of this part to the condition of the Roman Empire between A.D. 400 and 600 should be noted. At that time, you had the western half of the Roman Empire being crossed by various barbarian tribes, conquering, pillaging, destroying, settling down for a time in one area, moving to another. You have a condition of intermixture of peoples far greater than ever before. You have a weakness along with strength. You have the violence of the conquering tribes. you have a certain amount of strength remaining in the Roman Empire, but not much at that period. What it did have came from some of these people from these Germanic tribes who took service under the Roman leaders. And they were the gave what real strength there was in the Roman Empire during this time. But its name and its reputation still carried a great deal of weight. It's a period we can speak of as iron mixed with clay. It's a period of great intermingling of peoples. There is a marked similarity of those two centuries to that description. Now, number 5. Verse 34 says that the stone strikes the statue upon its feet of iron and clay. Verse 34 says that the stone strikes the statue upon its feet of iron and clay. Now, in a symbolic picture, there are apt to be many elements that are just part of the picture and don't convey a meaning, like the two arms, possibly 10 fingers. We don't know whether the fingers were shown or not, or whether Nebuchadnezzar noticed them or not, if they were. We don't know whether the arms were longer than usual or shorter than usual. But there were the normal features that a statue would have. So that to know which have a meaning, you need an interpretation, unless you have some feature that is very, very unusual. Like you have the unusual feature here of having different metals. Now the metals themselves, most of them, may not have a specific meaning, but the fact that you have a difference of metals certainly is an unusual thing, which has a meaning. That there is a change from one empire to the other. Well, now, the stone strikes the statue, it is specifically said, upon its feet of iron and clay. And since the statue represents a progression of events, when it is specifically said that the stone strikes the statue on the feet of iron and clay, that would suggest very strongly that the event described by the hitting of the statue by the stone and demolishing it was something that would take place in the fifth period, fifth part of the statue, rather than in one of the first four. That, it seems to me, is quite obvious. But there are those who do not like that idea at all. I notice in one commentary here that the statement is made, the striking of the feet is symbolical and does not necessarily have any particular reference to the fourth kingdom. The image is struck on the feet because such a blow will cause it to totter and fall. Where else would one strike a blow that would cause the entire image to fall? Well, that is a case where a man has a certain interpretation that he wants to stand for, and therefore he tries to twist everything in line with it or to explain away anything that doesn't fit with it. Now, this particular commentary, I'm not criticizing greatly on this account. It is a little worse than a good many commentaries on this direction, but not a great deal. Most do err somewhat that people approach with a definite idea in mind, and then they try to fit everything into their idea or to explain away what doesn't seem to fit with. It is specifically said that the stone strikes the image upon its feet that are of iron and clay. Why does it bother to tell us where it strikes it? Why not just say it struck the image and destroyed it? There would seem likely to be some reason for saying where it hits the image. But more than that, hitting it on the stone is a very unusual and strange thing. If one of you were standing here and for some reason I wanted to demolish you, I can't imagine I'd pick up a stone and try to hit you on the feet. I think that would be the last place I would think of aiming at. And if there were a statue here I wanted to knock over, I might hit it in the head, in the chest, perhaps even in the legs. But I can't imagine that I would hit it in the feet in order to knock it over. It is so obviously something that is unusual, something that is strange and is so specifically named here, that it is rather ludicrous when a commentator tries to get rid of it by a statement like this, which, of course, is an absurd statement. Where else would you hit it to knock it over? Well, anywhere except there. That would be the least likely place that you would ever hit it. So we notice that as a specific fact about the fifth part of the statue, that verse 34 says, that is where the stone strikes the statue, on its feet of iron and clay. Now that is E, and we'll now go on to F, which I have with me here, and we can observe. F is the dynamic series of events. We have been looking at the parts of the statue, the set figure that he saw. But now, as we noticed, things began to move. There is a dynamic series of events. Well, now let's look at the biblical statements about these. And here I have a reference to the sheet that I gave out to you. This was the assignment for last week, for you to look at them and see how the statements made related to each of these three events, which we have already noticed are here. The three events are the origin of the stone, the effect of the stone upon the statue, and the enlargement or growth of the stone. And so here I have taken verses 34 to 35, and verses 44 to 45. I've simply taken the King James Version of those verses, and I have arranged them to indicate which relate to these three events. You notice that in the account of the events, well, first there's an introduction, thou sawest until. That connects it with what precedes. He was looking at the image, then he sees these events begin to happen. The first of these is the origin. A stone was cut without hands. Then we have its effect on the stone. It strikes the image and completely demolishes the image. And it uses very strong language to show how every part of the image gets all mixed together and all carried off, so there's nothing left of it. And then I indicated by G here the growth of the stone. That is the third there. But in the interpretation, it begins with an introductory phrase, and in the days of these kings, then the origin is rather summarized. The God of heaven will set up a kingdom. That's not merely the origin. It summarizes the whole thing, you might say. But it specifically deals with the first and last part. It is the God of heaven who sets up the kingdom. But the stone filling the whole earth is paralleled by the fact that the kingdom he sets up will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left to other people. But then it goes on in verse 44 to tell about the demolition of the statue. But it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. And of course, we do not take that altogether literally. It does not mean that the people of those kingdoms are all broken in pieces. It doesn't mean the land is all broken in pieces or their buildings all broken in pieces. It means the characteristic features of these kingdoms are all demolished. Everything that was represented by the gold, the bronze, the silver, and the iron and clay is demolished. Everything that is typified by Nebuchadnezzar's empire and these other empires which ruled over the earth, most of them in defiance of God, most of them in utter disregard of his righteous law, they were to be broken in pieces and consumed. And then we have a reiteration of the fact, and it shall stand forever. Again, part of the last part. And then we go back to the origin again by simply repeating the statements of the vision. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and then a repetition of the destruction of this, statue. And that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. And then there is a final conclusion. Now I just have to say a word about the first phrase in the interpretation. The in the days of these kings. You ask immediately, what kings? And you will find many commentaries which tell you that they are kings who are described in chapter 7. Well, it is quite unbelievable that Daniel, in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, speaking to him, would use a phrase which was referring to something that was not revealed to Daniel until 45 years later. We can use a later revelation to throw further light on an earlier revelation, but we cannot read it back into the earlier revelation. My purpose in this course is not to find what the Scripture teaches about the future. My purpose is certainly not to give you my interpretation of all these matters. My purpose is to go through it with you, carefully seeing exactly what is clear and definite and what there is on which we perhaps do not know the answer and would have to wait till further revelation to find out. And so when here he says, in the days of these kings, the only reasonable interpretation would be that it means the kings already mentioned. And it has mentioned Nebuchadnezzar. And then it has mentioned kingdoms that follow him. The terms king and kingdom are sometimes interchanged. They are used rather loosely in the Scripture, whether referring to the man or referring to the whole kingdom over which he rules. And in this case, the whole context would seem to require that when he says, in the days of these kings, he means within the time represented by these four kingdoms and the fifth, whether it be part of the fourth or whether it be a separate kingdom. That's not made clear in this chapter, but it is made clear in chapter 7. In either case, it is in the days of the kings we have been talking about. Now there are commentaries that say, of course, this is referring to the 10 toes. They represent 10 kings, and in the days of the 10 kings represented by the 10 toes, this is going to happen. Methodologically, that is reading too much into this statement. It is only 45 years later that anything is revealed about the number 10 in connection with the fifth part of the vision. And so we are not warranted in reading that back. Now, if there was a statement made, there were 10 toes, something to call attention specifically to the toes, that might perhaps give a little ground for such an interpretation that the 10 toes represent 10 kings, but unless you have a statement here, it's very hazardous to read something like that into a picture. We may find that taught in chapter 7, but I don't believe we can read it back at this point. So here we must beware then of taking a view that has been adopted and reading it into what is there, either by saying 10 toes, the number of which is not mentioned here, and nothing said about the toes having a specific meaning any more than the fingers or the nose or the eyes or any other part, to now say that had a meaning at that time. Or on the other hand, to say when it specifically says something unusual, that it struck it upon its feet that were of clay of iron, to just say, well, where else would you strike it to knock it over? They are both at reading into it a previously established system. Now we want not to read anything in, but to read out what we find there. And so we go on from there to look specifically at these three events. And we look at number 2, the origin of the stone. And as to the origin of the stone, all that is said is on this sheet that I gave you this morning. As to the origin of the stone, we are told that the stone was cut without hands in Daniel's account of the vision. But in his interpretation, he says, forasmuch as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands. It does not say that the stone was a new creation. It doesn't say something came into existence that did not exist before. But it does say it was cut out. There is a new phase, at least. There is a new form. There's a new representation in some way. A stone was cut out without hands. A stone was cut out of the mountains without hands. We can very clearly draw from this the teaching that the origin of the stone is entirely supernatural. It is without hands. It is not something that any human being or human force produces. Now, the early church fathers felt that in this verse there was a very definite reference to the virgin birth. I'm not sure we can be quite as certain of that. We must certainly mention it as a possibility that the being cut out without hands refers to the supernatural birth of the Lord Jesus Christ. It is certainly a possibility, but one on which we certainly should not speak dogmatically, at least not at this point. Now, the second of these dynamic events is, of course, the effect on the statue. And the effect on the statue, we have rather fully described in the picture in verse 34 to 35, and also in the end of the interpretation in verse 45. It breaks in pieces all the different parts of the statue and breaks them to tiny pieces so that the wind carries them away and there's nothing left of them. The completeness of the destruction is surely emphasized here. This certainly does not represent something that is going to take place in certain sections of the world scattered here and there. It is something that completely eradicates the previous situation. The completeness of the destruction is stressed just about as thoroughly as anything can be stressed. There is in this an end to all that the statue symbolizes. All of human glory, all of human clever organization, all of human violence, all of human autocracy. All the things that are represented by the different parts of the statue. It is not merely the fifth part of the statue that is destroyed. They all are destroyed. Well, how can they all be destroyed when the Babylonian Empire came to an end at least many, many centuries before the stone strikes the image? Because the qualities of them are much the same throughout. There is a difference of name, there's a difference of language, there is a different culture. But that which is symbolized by Nebuchadnezzar's control and the activities of his government is found in the Persian government also, and is found in the Hellenistic government and the Roman government. Different forms at many places, varying amounts of freedom on the part of individuals within them, varying at different times within these governments. But there is always that big government autocracy control over the lives of people, often mixed with graft and with corruption and with violence and clever human organization and clever human planning, which is characteristic of these empires. And we are told that it is completely demolished, completely destroyed by the storm. So the completeness of the destruction is one thing that is very greatly stressed here. Then, number four, the growth of the stone. It is made very definite that the stone, it demolishes the image, completely destroys it, and it grows until it fills the whole earth. Well, the picture seems to be a picture of a rapid change. But it does not say that the stone grows at lightning speed until it fills the whole earth. It does not say even that the stone cut out of the mountain comes at lightning speed to hit the statue. neither of those statements is made. And so, while it is absolutely clear that it fills all the earth and that the statue and all that it stands for is completely demolished, we have a question. Is the growth gradual or rapid? A question which we cannot say is dogmatically answered in the picture. And then there is another question. When does the growth of the stone begin? Does the stone begin to enlarge, to fill the whole earth, only after the entire statue has been demolished? Or does the growth of the stone begin at an earlier time? That we cannot be dogmatic about, either from the picture or from the interpretation. And that finishes F, so we can go on to G. Capital G now gets us to various attempts at relating these dynamic events to history. Now, I have said relating these dynamic events to history. I haven't said relating the whole prophecy to history, because the four kingdoms are pretty clear. We have a long history about which we know many facts, and we have many remarkable points of fitting together between the picture as shown there and the events during a 1,000 years after the time of Daniel. And so we are particularly interested in attempts now to relate the dynamic events to history. And first we note the view of the critics. This is the view which was published in the 2nd or 3rd century A.D. by Porphyry, a view which was denied and attacked by Christian writers in the next few centuries, but which within the last 2 or 3 centuries has been adopted by most of the so-called higher critics and by many who would not wish to be called higher critics. And there are many commentaries on Daniel which adopt this view, the view of the critics. And according to this view, the book of Daniel was not written at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, but was written about 400 years later. According to this view, it was written at the time when a Syrian king, one of this Hellenistic empire, tried to put a complete end to the Jewish religion. And there was great persecution involved in this, and a group of Jews fled into the wilderness. And there they gathered together into bands which attacked the various parts of the Syrian control and eventually won complete freedom for Judea, a freedom which lasted for about a century. And these leaders came to be called the Maccabees. And so this is this period we can well speak of as the time of the Maccabees. And according to the view that is held by all the critics and by some who would not call themselves critics, the book of Daniel was written by someone at that period who made out to be prophecy what was really his knowledge of history, and thus showed, as if it was predicted 400 years earlier, the course of events up to his time. And then when you get to his time, it goes on in the prophecy, and what it contains is only wishful hopes. He believed, or at least he tried to make people believe, that they were to be delivered from their difficulties by God intervening and completely destroying this wicked power that was trying to destroy them. And so that is a view which it's surprising to find some men who are usually thought of as very earnest Christians presenting this view in their commentaries. For instance, F.W. Farrar, the author of The Life of Christ, which is highly regarded, has a commentary on Daniel in which he takes this view. And the same is true of Moses Stuart of Andover, both of whom have written some very fine Christian material, but who take this view regarding Daniel. I personally don't see how they can, because the New Testament definitely takes the attitude, Christ definitely takes the attitude, the Old Testament is entirely true and reliable. And when you look at the history, that is a great difficulty with this view, that according to this view, the time of the Maccabees has to be the fourth kingdom. And according to history, it's only the third kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar, as you have on your sheet of the history that I gave you all last week, Nebuchadnezzar's empire was succeeded by the Persian Empire, which lasted for 2 centuries, and that by the Hellenistic Empire. And so we have 3 empires. And the Romans came later, the fourth, and there are 4 empires in this picture. And either a fifth or a second part of the fourth. And so that is a very great difficulty with the theory. It imagines a median empire between the Babylonian and the Persian, though the book of Daniel specifically tells us that the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar was given to the Medes and Persians, putting them together as one empire. Now, that is one view then, the view of the critics. Now, a second view, which you will not find in any commentary as far as I know, is the obvious view as it might be seen at A.D. 750, if the New Testament were left out of consideration. In A.D. 750, a person who knew nothing about the New Testament could look at this picture in Daniel and say, there's the Babylonian Empire, conquered by the Persian Empire, conquered by the Hellenistic Empire, and then conquered by the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire stood there for as long as the two preceding ones put together. In fact, longer than the two preceding ones, maybe as long as the other three. It was a great, powerful empire until about 400 A.D., and then between 400 A.D. and 600 A.D., you have a period when the Roman Empire was largely broken into pieces, and when these German tribes were going through, seizing this part and that part and the other part, and at 400 A.D., the probabilities are that, let us say, 3/4 of the people in the Roman Empire could read and write. And by 500 A.D., at least in the Western Empire, I doubt if one person in 30 could read and write. There was a tremendous decline in every aspect of civilization during those years between 400 and 600. And then at 600, there came a new force into the world, a force which its followers believed was a supernatural force. Mohammed declared that God had sent him. He declared there is one God and Muhammad is his prophet. And he declared that all people should turn to belief in one God. And after preaching this for a number of years and getting about 8 or 10 converts and being in danger for his life in Mecca, finally he fled from Mecca and went to Medina, and there he started a new system, starting in to force people to adopt his view. And he filled the Arab tribes with enthusiasm for his teaching and also for the plunder they were getting. And the armies marched out shortly after 600 A.D., and within a very few years, most of the Eastern Empire had been conquered. The new Persian force that had developed had been completely overcome. All of North Africa had been overrun, and Spain had been taken, and it looked as if the whole world was going to fall into their hands. And so here you had something which its believers felt was a supernatural thing, something which seemed about to completely destroy the empires which preceded, which seemed about to grow so it would fill the whole earth. And so you have the obvious view as it would appear to somebody living at 750 A.D., if the New Testament is left out of consideration. But you have here, too, a great difficulty, just as we had with the critical view. The difficulty is that what appeared to be the case in 750 A.D. no longer appears to be the case today. There was this tremendous spread of Islam. this tremendous spread of Mohammedanism, which held the land of Israel for about 800 years. Jerusalem was in Muslim hands, which spread over a large part of the world, and which looked as if it was going to conquer the world, eventually became weak, and today would have comparatively little power in the world if it were not for the money that is received from the oil. It is today a comparatively weak force in the world. And so here is something which might have appeared to be precisely the fulfillment, but which did not work out. Now we look at certain other interpretations I was hoping to get over today. We will not try to get a conclusion as to the correct interpretation in chapter 2, but look forward after we do to further evidence from other sections.